Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week, I'm going to be taking a look at the Doctor Strange animated feature versus the Doctor Strange live-action feature. And instead of just doing a scene-by-scene of the live-action film, because it just came out, I thought I would compare it to the animated film, mostly because I didn't really love Doctor Strange the film. I thought it was, you know, marginal at best, and I was really looking forward to it because I think the animated film is an incredible piece of work in terms of superhero movies. I think it's really well done. I thought that they were going to take a lot of the lessons from the animated film and put it into the live-action film with Benedict Cumberbatch, and I thought, man, this is going to be, you know, kind of the spiritual of the Marvel Cinematic Universe films, where most of the films are, you know, funny, kind of action-adventure-y. Cap can be a little serious at times. Sometimes Iron Man can be a little bit serious, but there's like a tone in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that all the films kind of fit together. And I thought, ooh, you know, like maybe Doctor Strange will be the Marvel Cinematic Universe sort of Batman. You know, he's kind of twisted and deep and dark, and they did not go that way. But I thought the best way for me to kind of show what I didn't like about what they did in that film is to compare it to what I loved that Marvel did in the animated film, which is kind of amazing. I think the animated film's a better movie. But so I really want to compare them, and you can see kind of what I'm talking about. Now, I'm going to break these down into sections. So as I've done in previous original versus remake shows, I like to break things up and compare them via sections. So the first section I'm going to call sort of lead up to apprenticeship. And that's, you know, the origins, the stories are pretty similar in terms of the two movies, so they're really easy to compare. So the first chunk of the movie will be the opening up till just when he gets to, in one film, I believe it's Nepal, and in the other film, it's Tibet. And then the second chunk I want to compare is his, what I call his apprenticeship. So the training and the character development that happens while he's in these Eastern, you know, Himalayan monasteries, learning what he's to learn to become the Sorcerer Supreme that he becomes in both films. And then I want to talk a little bit about the magic systems in the films and, you know, what Doctor Strange himself is, his magic, and what is his specialty. And then I will compare the outros, the rest of the, how the films wrap up. Okay, so without further ado, let's jump in to the first chunk. So this is the pre-apprentice piece, and I'm going to start with the animated film because it came first. It was released on DVD back in 2007. This was not a feature cinematic release. Marvel has, you know, if you're a sort of a superhero fan or animated fan, Marvel and DC have both been releasing direct-to-video animated films of a lot of their superheroes. So Marvel's done. Marvel did a pretty good job with the Avengers, actually. The Avengers, Ultimate Avengers and Ultimate Avengers 2 are really good Marvel films. Marvel did a great job with Planet Hulk. Actually, one of their best is Planet Hulk. I think it's really, really good. The Iron Man film that they did, the Invincible Iron Man, not so great. DC has also done some stuff, and DC's even have become more, it's an interesting, they've taken a path in really becoming very, very slavish to the comics. So they did Batman Year One, they did Batman Dark Knight Returns Part 1 and Part 2, they did Batman the Red Hood, Batman and Robin, Son of Batman. So DC's really like pumping out the Batman product big time. I believe there's like some Superman stuff, Superman Brainiac, a couple of Justice Leagues, but it's primarily Batman-oriented in DC and some Justice League titles, while Marvel's kind of moved it around a little bit. But anyway, just so you know, if you're interested and you love the superheroes, they're generally done pretty well. I would say both sides have done a pretty admirable job putting them together. I wouldn't tip it in one direction from one side to the other, but if you love superheroes and comics and you know, you've, you know, you're waiting breathlessly for the next MCU or the next DCEU, I think it's called, you can check out these animated direct-to-video productions. So with a little bit of that info, let's jump in to the comparison. So again, we're going to start with the animated film, and the sequence starts the film leading up to his journey to Tibet. And just a brief reminder before I start, all of my archived shows are available on my website, scifionscreen.com, and you can buy them for 99 cents a show. I've got about 80 plus episodes that are in my backlog, and they're organized on a handy page on the website. It's called Podcast Index by Film Title, and you can just go and click on the films. They're all in alphabetical order. Takes you right to the download page, and at 99 cents a pop, you can, you know, download them and listen, and you'll have them for good. Please feel free to, if you like what you're hearing or you're new to the podcast and you like the shows, I've got about maybe 5 to 7 that I'm going to leave free. So there'll always be free ones definitely on the feed, the newer ones and some older episodes. The lion's share of my archives will be available for 99 cents. I'm doing this because I'm trying to, you know, make this quasi into a business that that could sustain me eventually, you know, at some point. So I'm trying this model over the getting sponsors and shilling all kinds of products that I may or may not use and any of that stuff. I thought maybe I would try a more traditional approach where I would sell each podcast as a product in itself. So anyway, let's dispense with the hawking my wares and let's jump into the comparison. So the animated film begins in the city sewers, and we're with these two workmen running from an unknown entity, and we see one taken, and a second makes it up to the manhole cover, and before he's pulled down, and then sort of the ground splits open, and the third guy in a truck starts to drive away, and we see this invisible force kind of rip the back of the truck off. And we have no idea what's going on since it's all invisible. Then we cut immediately to this group of magicians. We see who will later become Baron Mordo, who's this large man with long hair. And the first line of the film we hear is, "The beast is shrouded, use the eye." And so he makes this really cool sign with his hands, and the amulets hanging from the whole group of magicians all glow with this crazy light. This other magician named Wong makes another kind of curious motion with his hands, and all of a sudden we see this beast that has come up from the ground. It looks kind of like half like the giant manticore mixed with like kind of like these cybernetic lines on it. Like, it's really cool. It's definitely like a, you know, a fantasy creature, but it also looks a little like technical. It's hard to describe, but the design is really neat. And then all of a sudden, you know, Mordo creates a sword out of thin air, and this group of magicians attack this beast. So a couple of cool things during this attack. Each magician has a different type of power and is represented by a very special symbol. So one of them punches the ground, and as he does it, we see this circular, this cool circle. And the circles and the magical iconography that we see when they do magic, it's very sharp-edged and kind of tech. So it's a very cool mix here. They do a little bit of that in the remake, but very cool mix of, you know, sort of technical-looking, very sharp-edged magic symbols, and at the same time, it's magic. We see one of the magicians slam the ground, and the ground sort of, you know, deforms where he is, and then underneath the monster, we see the magic symbol appear, and this force that he used comes up and comes up and hits the monster. So he's got a cool kind of earth power, right? Now, they want to conceal this battle from bystanders, so Wong does some magic where, you know, it's all concealed from passersby. What it looks like to everyone looking on is as if a giant tornado was heading through the city. So that's kind of the illusion, that spell that's cast. In this initial action, immediately driving in the same down the street during this battle, Dr. Stephen Strange, and he sees the tornado, but as he's looking at it, he suddenly perceives the beast beneath, and he does this gasp and double take, and the tornado briefly forces him off the road. But it's a great beginning as to what I think they do really well here, is that we see from the very beginning that Strange has been touched with some ability that he himself doesn't even know yet. So then another musician, a woman, uses this cool power where she weaves these super strong strips of fabric, and they can cut or they can bind. As this big manticore is going up the side of a building, she throws up these cloth sort of lassos to hold it, And then Mordo's magic basically is to conjure weapons and kick ass. He's just a monster warrior. And he finally kills it, and when it's killed, it completely disappears. So then we get some dialogue between Mordo and Wong. Wong is worried, you know, Mordo, this does not concern you that the beast was so close to something called the Sanctum. And I'm going to, you know, approach this as if you're a new viewer and you don't know the Doctor Strange mythos, which I didn't before I saw the animated film. And Mordo just shrugs it off. It's like the beast is dead and he walks away. So we can see the beginnings of the rub of Wong's character and Mordo's character in this as well. So when they're all standing there after the beast is dead, they turn around and Strange is sitting there in his car and he can see them. And Wong weaves a yet a more powerful spell to conceal them. And it's done very cool. Like Wong waves his hand and this sort of wave starts to descend down, concealing Wong and the magicians, but you can see right through it then behind to the wall. It's just, I don't know, they could have done it 1,000 different ways, but it's just a very elegant thing. It just looks very cool when you see it on screen. And at that point, someone else in the troop says he saw through the spell, and Wong says, evidently. So again, we've had two instances where we see who the guy who will become the protagonist of the movie, he's touched by some sort of ability that, you know, he's not even aware of himself. Then we rock into a full credit sequence, but I felt here what it was an incredibly assured opening. The anime style is very beautifully drawn, good lines, great direction. I mean, anime now, they're doing such great things with anime action, as if there was a shaky cam in the anime scene moving the action to follow the punches and kicks. Although all the newer animes sort of do this style, and you can really follow the action. You know, in most animated films, when there's action, it's just, I don't know, it looks like a bunch of cartoon people going at it. But now, there's a new technique that's around where it's really cool to watch, and you can choreograph the action in a much more showy visual way when you do animated films because the camera will capture the choreography. It's really wonderful. So I don't know if you watch any of the later Batman films and, you know, some of the later Marvel films, you'll see this style in action where you almost feel like there's a shaky cam guy in the animated scene capturing the image. And it's really neat. But also what I love here is they don't dumb down to the audience. They don't explain too much right now. They go right into the story, and it's almost as if you're eavesdropping on this incredibly strange and odd scene. And the film's like, just enjoy the mystery of it right now and follow along, and you'll get it eventually, right? There's no, you know, they don't have to sell to all the seats in these. I think also, to be completely fair, you know, the cost of these animated films versus the live-action films is such that they can really target a specific audience that they know is going to buy this, and they don't have to PG-13 it to such a degree where, you know, they have to dumb it down so everyone loves it, right? So they can do it where they just jump you in and they're talking about magic, the beast is shrouded, use the eye. What's the eye? I don't know. Who are these magicians? What are they doing? Why do they have these powers? And no one says that, you know, there's nothing explained, and it's really mysterious, and I like it. So we cut right to a hospital, and we're right into the Doctor Strange character introduction. He's walking through the hospital doors, and an intern is stumbling after him, needing him to review patient files. And, you know, we hear all these cases, and he's dismissing all of them because they're not interesting, and they wouldn't get him on the pages of a journal. So the quote is, quote, "Would a medical journal be interested in any of these cases? Then neither would I." Boom. So we already have an initial character of Dr. Strange and who he is, right? He's this kind of superstar guy, doesn't really give a shit about the little man. Yet they keep things complex. When he gets to his office, he sits down and he sadly looks at this photo on his desk. And we don't know that it's him yet, but we'll find out later that it's him and his sister. And so then his boss enters and we get the notion via his boss that most of the people at the hospital don't like him. More character development, right? In this film, it's much more that he's kind of an uppity prick, that morally that he's become real compromised. Whereas in the remake, I feel like they do more with a hotshot surgeon, so we love him. In this one, we're really focusing on kind of what a douche he is. And we hear that his boss is saying, listen, you've got to return Gina's call. So Gina is sort of was an ex-lover of his, colleague, and it's sort of set up that, you know, Gina is the boots-on-the-ground doctor working in a hospital, you know, treating as many patients as she can, works really hard. And Strange is sort of like up in the clouds doing these really, really hard, very showy operations, taking these very special cases so they can be written up and make money for the hospital. So that's the setup. There's a walk between the two of them in the coma ward, and look who's come to the coma ward, the great Doctor Strange. And he's like, don't, you know, so that she's giving him all kinds of shit, and he's giving her line of like, the money I make keeps this place running, you should be grateful. And, at one moment, she's like, what happened to you, man? You know, don't you care anymore? And they just kind of blow it off. So she brings him to this patient. The child is in a coma, and he's about to dismiss it. And she shows him these brain scans. And she throws up one that was taken like a day ago where there was like two or three brain embolisms. And then she throws up one that she just took, and there's like 10 of them. Then she pulls back the curtain to show him that the entire coma ward is filled with patients who have the same problem. And then, so something is happening, right? Suddenly, the girl rises up in some fit. He touches her, and then we cut to him seeing this burning demonic face, which is what he knows in that moment is this is the face that the girl is seeing in her nightmare. And it spooks him to no end, and he kind of bails. And there's one point when he's waiting for the elevator, and the girl's mother is on her knees, please, in Spanish, right? Please help me, doctor. You know, you're my last hope. And he's like, I can't do it. Which is amazing. Like, again, you know, the setting up his character is not very sympathetic. Like, there's this poor, poor woman who's begging him to help her daughter. And he's like, you know, I can't help you. So I love that the film is brave enough to put their character in a, you know, right now he's a real ass. And we don't really like him very much. But the crappier they make him, the better the turn will come when he starts to kind of fall on his own, you know, fortunes and so on and so forth. But so I like that. Now he's driving home and we have the fabled crash. For whatever reason, he sees in a mist like all these children kind of on what he thinks is on the road walking towards him. They're kind of ghostly, and they're holding out their arms to him, and he swerves to avoid them and crashes through a fence off a cliff, and the car gets completely destroyed. So he wakes up in the hospital. His hands are bandaged. He's asking about the children in the road, and Gina was like, there were no children. And he sees his hands, which are completely bandaged, and he asks for his chart. He realizes that, you know, I think there's a line like, I'm lucky if I can ever hold a fork again. This is his life. That this is kind of like a great Marvel origin story where, you know, the thing that he prides in the most and that has made him who he was in his life, so he thinks, right, his hands are the thing that get completely destroyed. It's a great origin story. Immediately, he's realized that his career is ruined. There's a very small Easter egg in this moment in the animated film where you hear in the background, Dr. Donald Blake, please report to surgery, whatever. Dr. Donald Blake is part of the Thor mythos. Depending on what version of Thor you're reading, like Dr. Donald Blake became Thor or he was an alter ego. I'm not a big Thor fan, so Thor fans out there would know, but it's a fun little Easter egg. In the hospital hallway, briefly, Gina bumps into Wong, who we've seen earlier, kind of skulking around. There's a great scene of him arriving home where he comes in and the doorman's like, do you need help getting into your residence? No, I don't. And he goes up to his door and he can't, you know, he can't hold the key enough to get it into the lock. And then we cut from to inside the apartment and the door opens and the doorman is there. Just very elegantly done, you know, of how now he's at the mercy of almost everybody. So then there's kind of a montage scene where he begins to search for a cure for his hands and he flies to all these different places and we hear wonderful, you know, the same phrase repeated in these montages. I know a person. He's very expensive. The treatment is very experimental. And he keeps going around and sometimes he's part of the cure, directing them to do certain things, but nothing works. And he's slowly running out of money. I think there's a point where he's living in a rooming house. The old boss of his at the hospital won't return his calls anymore. He's grown a beard. So he's kind of going to seed in a bad way. We reach a point where he's out of options and he goes to a bridge. And he stands on top of the bridge and he jumps. But suddenly there's this kind of mysterious, you know, fade out and fade back in, and he's back on top of the bridge, laying, you know, sitting down, and Wong approaches. So we get a sense that Wong has saved him. Wong introduces himself, and he tells him that, you know, the cure for your hands is in Tibet, and he gives him a map, and he said, if you want to know more, you have to get there. But he has to do one more thing. Like, I like, first of all, that he had to that he was pushed to suicide, you know, before he was able to given this choice. Then he has to really humble himself because he has to beg, hide out in an underground parking garage and beg Gina, who he's kind of blown off now, for the money to get to Tibet because he completely has no money. And it's a very sad scene. Even in this moment, what a douche he's been in the beginning. We feel sorry for him, you know. So it's a great journey from quickly setting up the action to getting him to this place where he's about to surrender. So we're going to pause here, and we're going to do the same time frame in the live-action film. The live-action film opens in a Tibetan monastery, very foggy and dark, and we're inside this library room, and about 20 figures surround this librarian. We see some magic used in the way of these four sort of glowing whips that are lashed out. The librarian is suspended sort of spread eagled facing the floor, but levitating. And one other figure now approaches this guy, removes his hood, and we see immediately that it's Mads Mikkelsen, who I love, as Caecilius, who is the bad guy in this film. And he winds up cutting off the man's head in a very elegant fashion, and it falls into a basket. Then we cut to him removing a book from one of these kind of stand-up library shelves and tears out a couple of pages and drops it. Then we hear behind him a female voice telling him that the ritual he's taken will only bring you sorrow. And that figure approaches, and the entire group flows through some portal that's been opened into an unnamed city. But as they're walking, they're then stopped by this mirror. Behind them is the Ancient One, and we'll find out later who that is. But she has followed them, and now we get a scene of the surrounding city. It's kind of morphing like Inception on steroids, basically. I think what happens is she has moved them into what they call the mirror dimension, where they, you know, they can't really affect anything in the outside world. So they wind up having a fight on the street, and the buildings are turning on their side. So it's a very... It's an amazing thing. Like, it really is the Inception effects turned up to 11, right? So it's very cool to watch, and it's done very seamlessly. And the Ancient One's sort of magic is she creates these glowing discs in her hand, and they can serve as blocking weapons or cutting weapons, or she can throw them. And the fight's not very interesting for whatever reason. The morphing buildings are really fun to watch, but the fight just kind of feels stagey and not very well choreographed. I guess they feel because they're musicians, they don't do full contact, so they're supposedly magic fighting, but there's something about it that just seems very, very choreographed and dance-like and not very fight-worthy. And I think, you know, at this stage of action movies in good old 2017, any kind of adventure movie that's going to have fight scenes, man, they ought to be state-of-the-art, because that's, you know, the lion's share of your $15, which it's up to now in New York, is, you know, kind of the thrill we take at some of these things. So it's kind of, you know, that the fight scenes are lame is sort of like not a good harbinger of things to come. So now we cut to a hospital, and what the live action does, starting differently right here, is giving us a very sympathetic Stephen Strange with a sort of a side order of arrogance, right? But he's almost like Tony Stark. He's very, very smart and brilliant, smarter than anyone around him. And he's arrogant, so he has a little bit of a flaw that he's arrogant. But, you know, the tone of the movie now shifts, and we hear Earth, Wind, and Fire, Shining Star in the background. We think it's the movie, but actually, as we get into the operating theater, it's Strange's music to operate by. And we see it's Benedict Cumberbatch, who I love. Don't love him in this movie, but I do love him in lots of things. And we witness the surgery. So there's a bunch of med students standing outside watching him. It's like a big affair. You know, he's a very famous surgeon doing this very delicate procedure. So he does that, and while he's doing it, you know, another part of his cheeky charm is that he knows he has a photographic memory. As he's doing the operation, people in the operating room try to stump him by playing music and asking him what date it was recorded. And of course, he comes up with the answer. So, you know, he's like super smart, super great, the greatest surgeon whoever, rock star. So when he leaves the operating room, so in the animated film, this character named Gina is, in this film, her name is Christine Palmer. And I don't know the mythos in terms of Dr. Strange. I don't know who's the real, you know, who dates back to the comics. Maybe they both do, maybe one does. But Rachel McAdams plays Christine Palmer. Actually, Rachel McAdams is terrific in this. She kind of belongs in another movie, really. But she's grabbed him, and you know, another doctor has made a premature call of death, and Palmer thinks that it's wrong. So of course, Strange comes in, and now we have this thing where they must have done some research, and we get this incredible Strange's photographic knowledge and memory. I guess a bullet is lodged in this guy's brain, and they got brain death. They called the body dead, but Strange realizes that it actually hasn't killed him. It's chemicals from the bullet that are simulating it, or something like that. It's very clever, like what they came up with, and that the person's actually not dead yet, but it's just a reaction to the metal of the bullet. And if you got the bullet out of the brain, the person would revive. And the doctor's like, I called it. This patient is dead. And he's like, prep him back in for surgery. You know, like, so Dr. Kildare basically goes in there and he wants to pull the bullet out, but the computer thing, they won't have time to prep the computer manipulated arm. So of course he has to do it by hand, which that's impossible. No, it's not. He's the greatest surgeon who ever lived. So he does something and he wins, you know, wins the day. And Smarm smugly is sort of like, of course, you know, who did you think? And so on and so forth. So that's our introduction to Strange. In this film, he's great. He's basically great. He's awesome. He's better than anybody. Why wouldn't you love him, right? So then we have a similar conversation as in the animated film when Christine's like, I'd love to have you on my floor. And, you know, he argues that what he's doing, not, and his, they do it differently. What he, in the live action, it's not that what I'm doing brings in the money and money runs the hospital. He's like, the operations that I do save the lives of more people, right? It's a more balanced argument here, where in the animated film, we're painting him as kind of a dick, where he's like, I just do the shit for money, and that's kind of who I am. In this film, it's like, no, you know, he has a grander idea about what he does, and it saves more lives. And we don't get into the details for it, so we don't hate him for it. It's like a good-natured debate between two colleagues. It's very, very different. And I think the animated film takes more of a risk painting him as a real cold fish to start. So that night he has a speaking engagement. We get the tagline of what he is and what will come back. The Ancient One will tell him later. Where he has a speaking engagement, he's like, come on, Christine, come to the speaking engagement with me. It'll be fun. Like, no, it won't be fun. Oh, why not? He's like, this is about you. Don't you understand? Like, it's all about you. So, you know, whatever. That's the, he's an egomaniac, right? But then we set up how rich he is. He's choosing a watch and this incredible car that he's driving and all this amazing stuff. And he's driving to a speaking engagement. And as he's driving, a colleague is sort of running by potential patients, these specialized cases, and he's glancing down to look at x-rays. And at one point, actually, there's an Easter egg here. It's Rhodey from Captain America Civil War, where we say we have a, you know, we have a guy in who severed mid-spine in an accident, blah, blah, blah. And we know they're talking about Rhodey. So it's a kind of a fun little Easter egg if you know your Marvel Cinematic Universe. He looks down at an x-ray of one possible, and of course, you know, it's like driving and texting. He completely loses it, and we have the car crash as in the animated film, and it's pretty, you know, it's a little over the top. The way they show the car crash in this one, it's like, I'm amazed anyone walked away from it. He wakes up in the hospital with Christine. The hands look much more brutal in this. The animated film, they just had bandages on, but this one, they've covered closely with, you know, they've driven like 11 stainless steel pins into the bones, and we see all, you know, this, it's almost like he's got mechanical hands. They're so encrusted with this stuff to allow them to heal. And we hear that he has nerve damage. And then we do sort of the montage, as in the animated, him looking at x-rays. We see Christine shaving him. We fast forward to weeks later. Everything has been off and his hands are kind of healed scar-wise, but they're shaking. Like, you know, he can't even hold them still. And so he immediately goes into rage and he blames the doctors who operated on him. If it was him doing it, he would have saved his hands. And then, you know, very similar, these experimental surgeries. And in this film, actually, he's the one coming up with the ideas and telling people how to work on his hands because he's always in control and he's a superstar. Whereas in the animated film, he was kind of at the people's mercy, going here and there and hoping that people could help him. Here, like, he sits the doctors around the table and is like, okay, here's what we're going to do, blah, 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 because, you know, he's in control, right? And he's great. So at one point, they're doing physical therapy and his physical therapy trainer tells him that there was one person who walked away from a spinal severed injury. And he's like, I'm going to give you the file because you don't believe it. Strange berates him for being overly optimistic and all that. But so the trainer's going to go pull the file. So then we do have one scene between him and Christine where she comes, you know, buy some groceries and he's like enraged that, you know, you pity me. You think I had this coming, so on and so forth. And his apartment is nearly empty. He sold everything because he's out of money, spending it on these surgeries. So she leaves in a huff, right? He's alienated her. At one point, now he finally gets the file that this trainer had sent him, and he goes and finds this guy playing basketball. It's kind of funny. It's Benjamin Bratt in a bit of a cameo role. He tells Strange that he went to a place called Kamartaj in Nepal. He found a guru, and through the spiritual discipline, was able to heal himself. And we hear a tease that I didn't stay around to learn the greater mysteries, which were to be revealed to me. I got what I need, and I came back, and I'm fine. So we get the sense, you know, obviously we get a sense of there was more to be done. But once he could kind of heal his condition, he walked and he was happy. So Strange jumps on a plane and he's headed for Nepal. All right. So to compare the openings of the two films, they both take a little over 20 minutes. The animated film's like 23 minutes. The live action is like 21, 22 minutes. For me, like, what has been accomplished story and character-wise here? I feel like the animated film has really painted us a real kind of a dude who's kind of really just money-driven and very smarmy, very unlikable character, right? Whereas in the remake, we like this Doctor Strange. He's got a photographic memory. He knows everything. He's smart. He saves people's lives with his knowledge. Like, he's much more of like an immediately likable character. So that's the setup there. And how those both pay off, I will say later. And I think they do this for a specific reason, and I'll get to that at some point. But what has to happen in the animated film is he's pushed to the point of suicide, and then he's saved, and then he has to go humble himself in front of Gina, right? Whereas in the remake, what happens? Like, he runs out of options for his hands. He curses Gina out. She leaves the house. He goes to find a guy who's been to Tibet, and he goes to Tibet. So, you know, at one point, he's still, there's just something about that that's a lot easier, whereas I feel like in the animated film, like, he was going to jump off a bridge. Like, he's gotten to the point now where, you know, he's possibly willing to do almost anything. If he was willing to jump off a bridge because he thought there was no hope, what would this character be willing to do on the other side of things? Whereas what we're setting up here in the live-action film is that we're seeing the core of what's going to make Strange a good musician, and it's the same thing that made him a good surgeon. I think I said musician and I meant magician. And in the animated film, he's going to have to surrender stuff that made him a good surgeon in order to make him a really amazing magician, which in turn will allow him to be an even greater surgeon on the other side of it. But that's the setup here, you know. And I think if you're doing kind of a go to Tibet, learn shit movie, which is what this is, right? And I love them very much. If you're doing that film, there's got to be stakes for the character. And I think the way the stories are set up here, you're kind of in an Iron Man movie, really, in the live-action film. And in the animated film, you're in like a spiritual movie, in a way. You're setting it up to be because, you know, you're dealing with the character's real desperation. Whereas in this one, yeah, he's desperate, but, you know, he's still got all his brains and all his marbles, and he hasn't been pushed to the wall yet. And I think that's a huge difference when you're doing these spiritual quest movies, and it's going to matter. Okay, so now let's compare the two apprenticeship portions of each film, and I'm going to start with the animated film. So we cut right to Tibet. Strangers wandering on a mountainside, which is a little like, you know, no guides. He just kind of walked up the mountain, but hey. At one point, he takes out the map to try to orient himself, and it blows away. And at that moment, he, you know, screams that, you know, it's all kind of lost now. He's in the middle of the Himalayas. And he has no map. And in that moment, he sinks to his knees, and suddenly he's aware of these two massive stone guardians that appear not far from him, and he sees off in a distance this really cool design city nestled in sort of a hollowed out mountain. I like that. I like still that they're pushing the limits of him being completely at the end of his rope, right? He tries to commit suicide, then he humbles himself before Gina, and now he actually gets all the way there and he loses the map, and he just is like, at these moments, when he gives everything up is when he progresses forward spiritually. And I think it's a very subtle but amazing thing that this film trucks in. And I think it's spiritually accurate in a way where that's how you grow spiritually. That's how I grow. I mean, you get to your knees, man. You know, you don't grow spiritually when you're at the top of your game and everything's really great. Usually it's when you're humbled and you're down and but then you find some way to just kind of let it all go and just admit that you're there. And then something shifts. It's a pretty amazing process. But I think this film captures it. And what's amazing, right? When he gets to the end of his rope, he tries to commit suicide. And in that moment, Wong is there with the sort of a guide to Tibet. And then he has to swallow his pride and humble himself before Christine. And he does that and he gets the money to go. And now he goes all the way there. He loses the map. He throws up his hands in complete horror and the city appears, right? So it's just, so Greg Johnson and Craig Kyle, these two writers, man, they just, one or both of them really understand the nature of this kind of a journey that one makes, and they're nailing it in this film, which is really exciting for me. So he gets to the main monastery, opens the door, Wong answers, and leads him to the Ancient One. So they have this little sort of introduction ceremony where Wong and Strange are on their knees in front of the Ancient One, and Mordo is sort of standing in front of the Ancient One as if he's, you know, guarding him. And of course, Strange is very adamant that things happen, and, you know, his hands get fixed, so he gets up and moves towards the Ancient One. Mordo pushes him back, you know. The Ancient One voice actor, this guy named Michael Yama, is terrific, and the dialogue is really great, where Strange is like, I didn't come here for spiritual advice, I came here to fix my hands, this is not about your hands, Steven, it never was. Really good. At one point, the Ancient One's like, dismiss them, he's going to kind of send them away, and Strange says, cool, please, I've tried everything. And the Ancient One says, no, you have not. The question is, are you willing to, right? Just really great dialogue. You're at the end of your rope, and have you tried everything? And are you willing to step outside of what you know to go those extra steps. And I just love that. So he's granted leave to stay. So then they do this thing where he's given a small cot to sleep in, a small room, this little cell. And at first, the room is completely bare. There's a little bit of hay thrown on the ground. And Wong says, you know, comfort is a privilege, one that is earned. And so we're going to see this room change as his journey through his, you know, the spiritual journey that he takes there changes, which is wonderful. It's like an extra little visual tag that things are changing for Stephen Strange. While Strange sleeps, the team then is called out to face these beasts called Shadow Hounds, which are, they can't be seen in the light, only in the deep dark can you fight them. There's some friction between Mordo and Wong again. You know, Mordo's just like, we can do anything, don't be a coward, just, you know, he's just a pure warrior, and he doesn't truck in anyone sort of having anything to say about what's to be done other than we fight, we kill, we are victorious, right? They all appear in this place under a street lamp, and the hounds are invisible, and there's some cool magic use here. Again, you know, I like in this film that the magicians have different powers, you know, which I don't get much of in the remake. Everyone kind of has a similar thing going on. Here, another magician slams his staff down on the ground, and roots appear from underground to grab one of the hounds. And I thought, that's neat. That's, you know, probably the same guy who used the ground for power in the last battle. And I was like, that's very well thought out. And Wong sort of has these air-made cleavers that he throws and kills stuff with. Of course, Mordo just with his sword, the same old deal. There's this moment when they're in the street lamp. The light goes on a little brighter, and we see like hundreds of them. They're completely surrounded, and then we cut away. But so back at the Sanctum, Dr. Strange reports to his first day of work, which is basically scrubbing floors with brushes on his knees. You know, that's the beginning for him. You know, again, the first task is like, how am I supposed to do this with my hands? And the Ancient One's like, that's between you and the brushes. And eventually he figures out a way to tape the brushes to his hands so he can scrub the floor. So then we cut to the team returning after the Shadowhound battle, and they've been decimated and several have died in the attack. And now we're talking about that these creatures are, you know, the more of these incidents are happening because someone named Dormammu, this is the first time we hear the name, who is the demon whose fiery face that Strange saw earlier, is trying to break into the world. We learn a lot more later about this, but here we just get a sense that somehow his power is rising. And yet the gateways that are barring him to come to this plane of existence are shut and locked and sealed. And so they don't know how his influence is increasing. And again, what's great about what we'll find out later about how his influence is increasing is connected to Strange back in his hospital doctor days. Like, so it's all unified in terms of his ability to help do things. And I'll get to that later. But it's very good unified writing in this, that all the action and everything that happens makes sense. It's not just thrown together like kind of a careless film. At the end of Strange's day, scrubbing the floors, he comes back to his cell and he sees a fresh mat down with a little more padding, right, that he's earned, which is great. And then we have a flashback to him and his sister. We continue the story, and we see the sister sitting in a doctor's office, and we hear in the background that Stephen is arguing off screen with the doc who won't operate on her because the doctor that he's arguing with thinks there's no point, that she's terminal. So he comes back out and he's like, look, I'm about to finish med school, and in 6 months I'm going to be your doctor, right? So we're seeing him now when he was young, that he cared a lot. And that his sister, I don't know if I mentioned earlier, there's a flashback scene in the earlier part of the movie where he was horsing around with his sister when he was young. She had this brain seizure, which is really kind of a startling scene in the movie where he was messing around, putting lipstick on her because she was, I guess, in her mid-early teens. And in the midst of that, she's in extreme pain with this garish sort of lipstick on her face. And it really looked weird and startling. So here, now, you know, we see that he's kind of dedicated to her and wanting to save her life. He thinks that he knows what has to happen to cure her illness. So it's a great contrast to the douchebag that we've seen. You know, it makes him a very complex character, like that he's having, that we're seeing this thing in his past, and it's going to continue on, and it's going to be all part of him breaking through and claiming a greater sort of latitude in his powers, that he's going to have to deal with this memory. But it also shows the sympathetic side of him, which I like. So then we get this wonderful, it's kind of very meta, but it's this great metaphor of this wall he has to keep smashing apart. So now instead of scrubbing the floors, they give him a sledgehammer and a bucket and a sort of a sled, and he's got to break down these old walls, you know, in and around where the sanctum is located. So we see him just smashing the rocks down and carting away the rubble, and we see a time lapse of him finally removing it completely. And then that night, we see a blanket in his cell, so he's earned that blanket. And then the next day, he goes back out, and the wall has somehow been rebuilt as if it were never taken down, right? And we're going to understand how this applies to him as a theme very soon. So then, you know, Strange starts to get frustrated, and there's some dialogue between him and Wong, and he's like, look, this is about my hands. And Wong's like, it's not about your hands. And Strange is like, well, then what am I doing here? You guys keep rebuilding the wall. I'm scrubbing your floors, and it's not about my hands. I'm out. So he walks out of the city and into the mountains. And so then we finish up the story with his sister, where he goes to operate on her. And it's kind of a touching last scene where she's like, where he's like, when you wake up, you're going to be all better. You know, wait till you get my bill. It's very cute, very nicely written. Of course, then we cut to an empty table and him crying. And obviously, we recognize that he was not able to save her, which, pretty hardcore, man. I mean, like, him losing his sister in this way. And he's crying, throwing things around the room. And in that moment, we realize that he's kind of in that memory. The Ancient One enters. And there's this great line where he says, quote, love, loss, pain. There are stones in the wall that block your path, Stephen. See the wall for what it is and tear it down, end quote. So, you know, very meta from the wall. He was just breaking down and continuing to rebuild itself is sort of the metaphor for what's happening here, that he can't let go of this. And he keeps returning to this place over and over again. And the guilt is just kind of ripping him apart. And he's being confronted with the truth that no one could have saved his sister. And that was the thing that he didn't want to confront, that not even he could save his sister. You know, and him with all his powers and all of his skills and everything, that even he couldn't control this outcome, right? And for him to accept that, and he can break free of that place and break free. And that's just, it's a beautiful message. I mean, you know, part of why I love books and movies and stuff is to hear it's not easy walking through this life being a human being. So, you know, it's nice to see when someone really treats some deep stuff and, you know, they talk about what a lot of people face and they put it in the movie and make it part of the story. And it makes the character really neat. And I thought, you know, when I saw this, I thought, man, if they do this in the live action film, this is going to be something to see, right? I'll get to that. Now he returns the next day. He comes back. He returns to the wall and he continues to break it down. That night, then there's a big tub in his cell and another little smaller tub for him to clean himself and bathe, right? So as he's continuing along this path and pushing forward, we see it visually, representation of it, which I love. The Ancient One says to Wong, like, he's just about ready, right? Then there's a scene between the Ancient One and Mordo. Two more of these massive creatures appeared and are advancing on the Sanctum back in the city. I guess they don't say it specifically. I don't know that it's New York. But so there's this discrepancy between the Ancient One and Mordo. Mordo wants to create two teams and deal with them simultaneously. And the Ancient One's like, you know, you're not strong enough for this. Do one and then move on to the next, right? And of course, once Mordo and the rest of the team ports to the city, he's like, we're going to split up into two teams. So he's going against the Ancient One's command, which is going to cost the life of, you know, a lot of the other magicians. So during that time where they're fighting, Steven is back at the wall with the Ancient One. And this is very much Empire Strikes Back Yoda right now, Jedi training. And then the notion here is that he needs to accept the unacceptable. So he, you know, he's lugging away these huge stones and they're really heavy. And the Ancient One's kind of like, well, you perceive them as heavy, so they are heavy. And then he forges a sword from air, and he's like, a sword forged from air. Is it real? Does it cut? And there's this notion of, like, you perceive that it's real, you perceive that it can cut, and so it does. So there's a great notion of how some of this magic works, and that it's just kind of perception and will, in a sense. And suspending your belief of, you know, what you've learned in the rational world up till now. And he's got to really, really let go and allow himself to, you know, focus on other ways things can be perceived or manipulated. The Ancient One does a big move and he cuts the stone block that he's carrying with the sword. And so then there's a brief moment where the Ancient One touches his hands. And all of a sudden you see the Strange is like, wow, he can move them again. And he says, you know, manipulate the forces surrounding your hands and limitations will not be there, you know. So really getting a sense of, you know, the next stage that he's going to have to go through. And so now we cut back to the city and we get the full battle between the other two monsters. The creatures are huge and brutal. I think they're bigger than the ones that we saw earlier. And again, there's great fighting. All the spells are kind of different. There's holding spells. There's the different kinds of magic, which is really great. you know, Mordo urging people on to take risks, and they, you know, a bunch of the people get killed. So he's been very, very kind of out of control at this point, Mordo, where he thinks that everyone can do everything, and he's getting people killed. So when Mordo gets back, the Ancient One is really like, you know, this was way out of line, and because of you, people are dying. And Mordo's like, well, maybe a warrior is needed, and you should step aside. And so the Ancient One kind of lets him know that the Sorcerer Supreme was never yours, Mordo. And Mordo's like, well, whose is it I desire to know? And he says, one that does not seek it, which I love, right? I love that. He's not after it. And Mordo's like, what is my role here? And he's like, you are to train him. So we're setting the stage for kind of the confluence of these magicians come together. So now we cut to Mordo and Strange training, sword training, and Mordo is pressing him hard. And we get the sense that Mordo's trying to kill him. And at one point, if Strange is so outmatched, it forces him to take an overhand blow by Mordo, but something happens where he takes all of Mordo's magic and his might and uses it against him and blasts him back across the square. So, you know, now because of all this work that Strange has done, now he's tapping into stuff that, and now he's being pressed by other training. He's digging into places and finding out what his unique magic is. And the unique nature of the magic in this is that he has this power to use someone else's power against them. And the genius about this is how they're going to use it at the end of the film. Basically, Wong realizes that Mordo's probably going to try to kill him, so he takes over his training. And then we kind of have the last part of the classic training sequence. They're training martial arts together. And at the very end, kind of now symbolizes that Strange has passed into mastery. He makes a mirror out of water. And then he forges a razor out of air and shaves, right? And he couldn't do that in the beginning when his hands were down. He couldn't even shave. So, and then he walks out of his cell. He's got the sort of Doctor Strange robes and his hair and the goatee are good to go. And you know that, like, all right, he's a full-fledged member now. So I'm going to pause the animated film and we'll jump out over to the live-action film to cover the same part of the story.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
I wait with great anticipation when that day comes, but unfortunately, it is not with us. I just want to take a brief moment to let you know some ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. Patreon at patreon.com is a great way to support any podcast. And that you go to Patreon, you find the podcast you like, you set up a schedule where you would contribute per podcast, and it could be as little as a dollar a show. And the great thing about Patreon is you don't pay a monthly fee regardless of what happens. Only when podcasters produce shows do you actually support them. So you can set it and forget it. You can do it as little as a dollar a show. You can change or quit at any time. So it's a great way to show your appreciation for the show. You could also make one-time support donation at PayPal by using the email scifionscreen@gmail.com, and you can go and make a quick one-time donation as well. And non-monetary ways you can support the show is please share the show on your Facebook page or in some groups that you like. Maybe share it on Reddit. And also, you can go to iTunes and the review, and please tweet it on Twitter. It would all be a great way for you to help get the show out and known to more people. So we last left Doctor Strange in the live-action film when he went to find Benjamin Bratt in a parking garage and found out about Kamar-Taj. What they don't do here is we don't know how he gets the money to go, and we don't have any last moments with Christine. We're just there. He gets the Kamar-Taj. I guess it was pretty easy, or it was the last of his money to get there. And the place looks great. I mean, a really, really great set design. It looks very lived in and very real. We see a black hooded figure following him around as he's walking, asking everyone, do you know where Kamar-Taj is? So in an alley, three thugs want his watch. And you know, he'll give up money, but he won't give up his watch. And we don't know yet why. But so they're beating the crap out of him. The black cloaked figure reveals himself as Chiwetel Ejiofor, I believe, the guy who is the star of 12 Years a Slave, and he's been in a bunch of stuff. So he, you know, kicks their butts, and the fight is too fast. There's no real choreography here. They just cut two strikes, and they cut often and a lot, and it's just like a lot of action, and then the three guys are down, and it's not very interesting. So Kamar-Taj is basically a monastery that's in that town that he's in. It's just a door in the city, so I don't know. It was kind of like a letdown in that way. So now through all this, the difference in this film is that Strange is smarmy and jokey and very cocky and confident all throughout the whole training process. There's rarely maybe one time another when he's generally, he's not desperate. He hasn't been broken down yet. He still has his cocky charm and he still has his like, I can do anything and I'm great. You know, I think at this point I was starting to understand that the writers want him to be part of the Marvel extended, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is not a serious place. Like it's not a Nolan Batman place. It's not even the DC Cinematic Universe up till now, which as crappy as it's been, has been very serious. I think they're even trying to change that. If the Justice League trailers are any indication, that they're trying to inject a lot of humor into their world to make it more like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So this is the beginning of having Strange be like Tony Stark as a magician. And as I'll narrate, as I go through this, like I think it undercuts his whole journey and it undercuts the film. They're inside the compound, and what's revealed here is that the Ancient One is Tilda Swinton, basically. So, okay, whitewashing perhaps, but a man for a woman. So, I don't know. That's take it or leave it as you were. To me, if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And Tilda's great, and she's very serious, and she has a presence and a sense about her that is a little uncanny. I mean, Tilda's always kind of a little uncanny, right? But she's good in this. They dub her the Ancient One. I feel like if you get, for whatever reason, she doesn't... It's just a weird mix when they say the Ancient One and I see her. And maybe that's just my bias, but it just doesn't work. I don't know. Maybe that's my bias and I want to see an old person when you're going to dub them the Ancient One. Maybe they should have named her something else, but I don't know. It's a weird juxtaposition when they keep calling her the Ancient One. So the dialogue is okay here. It's not nowhere near the penetrative dialogue of the animated film. It's almost as if, you know, the writers in this film picked up a couple of books on Zen and just kind of pulled out some quotes and threw it in there. There's a moment when he's just being snappy and he's chiding her about, you know, I'm not here for chakras or all this kind of spiritual crap. And she gives him like a chest punch and his, you know, astral self emerges out of the back of his body, right? So it's a startling image, right? But it's not very deep. It's just very showy. Like, okay, so she's showing him that all of the special stuff exists. Then immediately she puts hands on his forehead and they do this kind of 2001 kaleidoscopic trip through, you know, the multiverse, basically. And we get this trippy voiceover about what the worlds are, and you have no idea what what exists on these worlds. And yet, to me, he hasn't earned any of this. He hasn't earned the right to look. He hasn't surrendered anything. Yeah, he got there. But basically, she's showing him all the marbles, and he hasn't done a damn thing. He hasn't surrendered anything or let himself go or been put through any kind of spiritual or physical test to push him. He's just been as a smartass. The Ancient One now shows him the whole Megillah. And something about that I thought was like, there's no journey there. There's nothing about, I don't know. It was just, it's really, really weird. And then she throws him out. So then, you know, then I don't know what the writers were trying to do here. Like, who wouldn't want to come back after seeing all that magic and all that special stuff? Of course you'd be sitting at the door and waiting to be trained, because you've been shown that there's this very sexy jewel at the end of your journey. Whereas in the animated film, they constantly tell him that it's not about your hands. And only when he kind of surrenders and moves forward, they give him little breadcrumbs like, you know, oh, you can do this. And you know what? If you try this, this would work. And try this and try that. And they slowly bring him through into showing him Megillah. And even at the end of his apprenticeship training, they haven't showed him anything yet. He hasn't walked through portals. He hasn't seen the multiverse. He doesn't know about Dormammu. He's still working on his own stuff. So the journey matters, and he's getting for what he's giving. But here, it's just very showy. So now he's, of course, outside the door, and eventually, you know, they wait a while, and they let him back in. And we see him in his cell. Now, he has the same kind of cell like in the animated film, and the only thing in there is the watch. Like in the animated film, it was a picture of Strange as a boy and his sister. And this one, it's the watch that Christine inscribed for him. So when they were dating. So, you know, okay, so his old girlfriend's watch, like it's nowhere near as interesting or penetrative as, and we have no idea what their relationship was like, except that it was brief and then ended. Doesn't really matter much, frankly. So then his training starts. So he's sitting across from the Ancient One, and we hear a bit about how the mystic arts work, and they draw energy from other dimensions to create things in this dimension, which is very similar to the animated film. And she creates this magic symbol, which is very cool, very similar to, like, they do a lot of sharp glowing lines here, and the same kind of magic symbols that we saw in the animated film, they do a really beautiful version of them here, which is nice. It's kind of it's cool when magic, it's not what you expect, but it's this very, it's almost like a cyber icon in a way, but it's magic, so it's really neat. So this training is all about book learning. So he's returning a book to the library at one point, and he meets Wong, played by the awesome Benedict Wong, who I love. He's a favorite character actor of mine. There's more joking with, you know, the thing between him and Wong. Wong never laughs. Strange tries to tell him jokes to make him laugh. And of course, already now, he's already brilliantly finished most of the entry-level study work because he has a photographic memory, which we were introduced to earlier in the film. So that's great. You know what? He went through medical school, right? So this is kind of like another medical school for him. It's not hard. He's brilliant, and he's already passed most of the first-year stuff. And so Wong allows him access to the master's library. And of course, because the story needs to, he's ultimately drawn to the book that Caecilius took the pages from so we can get some exposition about it. And it's kind of a clumsy little scene, and Strange tossing off quips. And then we cut to Caecilius and some conjuring ritual. We see more symbols being conjured, and their eyes now change and get black and sort of as if they were deteriorating. And we see the face of this demon appear briefly, and there's more of the structure deforming of the surrounding buildings, which is cool. I mean, it's just, you know, it's neat. It can't save a movie, but it's really neat when that stuff happens. And the facial makeup and the, you know, the what's going to mark Caecilius and his followers is this kind of weird black eyeshadow and sort of silver patterning around it. It doesn't look very good. Like, it's not very interesting. It just kind of looks stupid. I don't know. They look like kind of aging rock stars that are like in an 80s tribute band or something. It's just, and so, you know, not very interesting. Back to Strange's training, we're introduced to these things called sling rings, which are used to create portals to travel anywhere in the world and anywhere, you know, in the multiverse, I guess, if you're powerful enough. They do the thing here where Strange can't make a portal, and everyone else in his class is making them, but he can't. So what the Ancient One does is basically throws him, she makes a portal, brings him to Everest, and then leaves him there and says, you're either going to freeze or make a portal to come back. There's that, right? And so they wait, and all of a sudden he collapses back into the school through a portal that he made, so he actually was able to do it. So, you know, she realizes that he's kind of has to be forced, you know, in the sense of the point of death, to accept things that he won't accept. It's a kind of a glimmer in there, but again, it doesn't lead to a cohesive way that Stephen Strange changes and grows into this magician. Then all of a sudden, because of the success, right, he shaves and now he has the whole beard and the getup where supposedly he's like a master because he was able to port through something in complete desperation. It's way too fast. Whereas the whole, you know, becoming the Strange look didn't happen in the animated film until like he was really all the way done and had to really break through some tough stuff. And then he became a master. So to me, it's way too soon. But now he's bugging Wong for books on astral projection. He's really fascinated with it. And of course, there's a funny moment. Wong refuses. It's too soon. And we see behind Wong that Strange is porting in, stealing books left and right. And his skills are improving very quickly. Then there's a scene where the Ancient One shows him this mirror dimension where he can practice his spells. And again, he's just doing really well. It's not very difficult for him. There's nothing really much at stake for him. The fact that his hands are destroyed and that he wants them back hasn't caused him any kind of real desperation as long as he's been at this school. The minute he's shown up, it's almost as if the hands weren't anything that he was worried about. He was just constantly joking around and trying to one-up everybody. So there's a weird mix. I don't think they really knew what they were trying to do. Or if they did, someone else stepped in and changed some things. Because it just, to me, it does not work. So then we get the problem here. And the idea is with these spells, Caecilius is going to destroy the world, which is just a very remote and unconnected problem to what's going on right now. Which, to me, it's sort of like, it's a real stock like, well, he's a bad guy and he has this thing which will destroy the world. And that's what these magicians are all about, to protect the world from stuff like this. And the animated film made the connection to Strange in the hospital and it's part of his journey, which was wonderful. And here, everything's very kind of disconnected. So then there's a sparring match between Mordo and Strange. And in this film, Mordo is kind of a sympathetic character. I think they're grooming him to be the bad guy for like a sequel. But at this point, you know, it's really Caecilius is the bad guy and Mordo is Strange's mentor to a degree. We hear about Caecilius, but it's a really garden variety villain story. He came to Kamertage just like Strange did. He learned everything, but he grew disenchanted and he learned too well, questioned everything, and left. Who cares? Give me a story about what he did that scares me. Give me a story about the kind of magic that he was into that made him dark and mysterious and interesting. That, well, you know, Caecilius was interested in this kind of magic and he created the spell that did X and was banished. Something, you know, it's all very generalized and it's, in a sense, it's kind of boring. So in the library, now we have this moment where he steals this forbidden book. And he puts on this Eye of Agamotto and he attempts one of the spells from the book. And so he learns how to affect time, which is kind of cool. It's kind of like there's this magic gauntlet on his hand. And when he turns the dial one way or the other, and we see it in action because at the table when he came in was an apple. It's a little clumsy. It was an apple that had one bite taken out of it. He takes a bite out of the apple and puts it back down. And when he controls time around the apple, we see it go to the core as if it's been completely eaten, or he pulls back time and it's completely whole again. So we sense what he's able to do. Then he uses the spell to bring back the pages of the book that Caecilius stole, which I thought was very clever. And we finally hear the name Dormammu. So Wong and Mordo stop him from continuing on. He's still joking with them like it's no big deal. And now we get a lot of what I don't understand. Mordo is like, I can't believe that you understand what's in that book. That's like, you know, only the ancient one really can understand what's in this. And Strange is like, oh, I have a photographic memory. And Mordo's like, well, just a photographic memory isn't enough for you to, you know, understand what's in there and to create these spells. You must have a special power, right? This is the first time we're getting the sense that he has this kind of power. It was nowhere else in the movie. Whereas in the animated film, because he could see through the spells at the beginning and a couple of different instances, we got a sense, and when he touched the girl, we got a sense that he was connected to these things. And it even kind of astonished him because he experienced it himself. Now we're like, you know, almost an hour into the movie. And because he can do, you know, he's come here and he's done all this fancy stuff. It's not taken him very long. And he's better at it than anybody because, you know, he's using the same powers that got him into being a douche to win here. And I feel like that's not the spiritual journey. Like, if he could will himself to just be awesome, he wouldn't need to come to a place like this. So for him to come to somewhere that's like a spiritual journey and he's using the same willpower and brainiac and smarmy talents that got him where he is in the world, where's the journey? Where's the sacrifice? Where's the difficulty? He's just still awesome. And he's going to, you know, Stephen Strange from the world is going to show all these magicians how awesome he is in their own backyard. And I think that's just not interesting at all. So I'm going to pause there. And again, I've been kind of been comparing them as I go, but I feel like about the same amount of time has elapsed. The animated film stopped the training in around 50 minutes in. This is just about an hour for the live action. To me, the animated film had the journey really well. And the live action film, it's just Strange wisecracking his way through this really cool place that has spells and cool powers. And I'm bored. So anyway, let's move on to the last part of the film. So I'll start with the animated film. Now Strange is a master and he travels with the entire group of magicians through a portal and he arrives back in his home city, which I don't think was ever named. So now we get the big info dump and the information about who these magicians are and what they do. So the Sanctum, and there's only one in this film, is a nexus that all interdimensional worlds of whatever level connect via this nexus here at the Sanctum. And it's the magician's task to kind of guard it, regulate it. And we get this wide vista of the nexus, the center of all dimensions. And basically their role is to defend it from this demon Dormammu, who dwells in the dark dimension full of corrupted magic. So at one point we hear the backstory. Dormammu came through to try to take control of the nexus, but the ancient one drove him back and sealed him in. And at this point, all of Dormammu's creatures have been killed except one last creature that's on its way to the city now. And we don't know yet what that creature is, but it's coming. We're hearing that the Ancient One's still unaware of how Dormammu's influence is flowing in to this dimension if the gateway is still blocked. And it is still blocked, as they show us. So, but as we zoom through this dark dimension briefly, we see some of the ghostly aspects of the children. So then the plot's revealed. The Ancient One says, now here's the great thing is that it takes Strange to give the information about this coma wards full of children that are seeing this, you know, face of Dormammu in their dreams. So we get this information that Children have a unique ability when they dream to pierce the veil between these different worlds of the Nexus. And so when the Ancient One hears about what Dr. Strange has to say, he figures that Dormammu has figured out a way to manipulate this little window and come through that veil. So, very clever, I thought. And again, connected to, you know, the beginning, the Coma Ward, what sent him off the bridge to crash his hands. Like, it's all unified. Just really good storytelling. So the plan now is for most of the magicians to stay at the Sanctum and protect it from this last monster, and for Strange to head to the hospital and wake up all these children. And the more he wakes up, then all these little doorways start to close, and Dormammu is kind of blocked from coming in. We basically have our end game. Mordo kind of tags along with Strange, and Wong stays with the Ancient One to defend the Sanctum. At the hospital, Strange kind of figures out that not just that hospital, but all the Coma Wards in the entire city are completely full with Dormammu's sort of, you know, hostage children. But he's able to go in and just basically touch their shoulders and release each one. So while this is happening, the magicians battle the final of Dormammu's monsters, which is something called the Wind Morgue, which is a very cool, I mean, basically, it's a flock of flying piranhas, if you think about it. It's a really creepy, kind of cool last monster. Just, you know, these flying, flappy-looking fish with massive teeth. So it's really, I really thought it was a clever monster. We get a sense of what the monster is, and then we flash back to Mordo, who, through one of the children, appears to Dormammu in the dream and offers his service. So he's pretty much done with, you know, the magicians, and he's willing to be Dormammu's slave to rule when the Dark Dimension comes to be. So now we see the attack of the Wind Morgue, and it basically strips people to the bone, and we see it strip someone in a car, and it's really well shot. The animation is great, where we see it come in and kind of circle around. And then when it's gone, it's basically like a skeleton that's left, sometimes not even a skeleton. Dormammu basically makes his move. Strange couldn't get all the children awakened. There were too many of them. All the children rise up and walk out into the street, open their mouths, and this energy of Dormammu kind of flies up into the air, and he appears, and there he is. And he blasts Strange initially, who is now unconscious. Wong kind of pulls him out of the fray. And he understands now that Mordo has gone over to Dormammu. So then there's the battle of the Wind Morgue, and none of the magicians survive. They're all eaten, and it's pretty terrible, actually. It's like, you know, it's a pretty horrific death for all of them to be consumed by this kind of amazing, creepy monster. But it's a very cool fight, and the Ancient One holds out the longest, and all of the weight of this Wind Morgue comes to bear against the Ancient One, and he beats it by kind of channeling this massive amount of energy, which explodes outwards and kills them all, so they're gone. But he's pretty much exhausted, and then Mordo comes upon him and kills him. Wong gives Strange the Eye of Agamotto, which had belonged to the Ancient One, and tells him, you're now the Sorcerer Supreme, right? So Mordo now attacks, and him and Wong fight briefly, but Wong is overpowered. So now it's Strange and Mordo, and it's very satisfying how Strange completely dominates Mordo and beats him, and he's completely done. But and Dormammu is disgusted with Mordo and winds up killing him. So Mordo's kind of out of the picture at this point. At this point, Dormammu has opened the gateways to Earth, and all his creatures are flying in, and it's basically curtains. And then we have the Strange versus Dormammu fight. So Strange is getting kind of knocked around. He's barely holding his own. But Wong tells him Dormammu is a creature of pure magic, use this against him. So he uses the power that we've seen him display against Mordo, and that you're pure magic, give me all your power now. And so he opens the Eye of Agamotto, and Dormammu's entire being is drawn inward to the Eye of Agamotto, in which fact he's, you know, we don't know if he's dead or he's just trapped in there, but it's over. And I love this because he wins using the magic that is particular to him that we've already seen him use. So it feels very real. It's like, you know, in a weird way, you know, when you fight bosses in video games, right? You beat the final boss, usually, if it's a well-designed game, because all of the things that the final boss exhibits, you fought versions of that in previous bosses and learned how to counter them. And then the boss is like your final exam. You have to put all that together and beat a character that does all those things, right? So I feel like in some ways, too, you know, Strange is able to use other people's magic against them. Now, this is his final exam to be a master at his power. It's very unified, and I think it works really, really well. So we have a brief epilogue. It looks like Gina, you know, back from the hospital, is on a picnic, and Strange comes up and says, "You were right about me. It is time we're going to start giving back." But she wakes up, and actually he had visited her in a dream. Then he and Wong go to his sister's grave, right, to kind of pay his final respects, which kind of ties that off. All the children have been awakened, so they're all free. So they're going to rebuild the sanctum, which has been destroyed. And Wong says that they're, you know, they're checking for new sensitives to see if they can, you know, they need to rebuild their ranks. One especially called Clea is most promising. And I'm not a big Doctor Strange comic reader, but I know Clea plays a big part. I think Clea is like his wife or his partner for a long periods, or at least a big player in the Strange comics. So it's kind of clever. And then we're out. Okay, so we're going to shift over to the live action. This is the last piece of the podcast. I'm going to follow the live action film to its conclusion. So basically, at the point when Strange becomes a master, he doesn't necessarily graduate into becoming a master. It's very, very vague. He just kind of, he cuts his hair and he has a goatee, and now he's kind of the man. But it's not a very clear delineation when he sort of becomes a full-fledged magician. But so he's in the library with Wong, and basically we're getting the big info dump now of who these magicians are. And in this one, they're defenders of the realm from mystic threats. And there are three sanctums, one in Hong Kong, one in London, one in New York. And we see a graphic of how the, you know, each sanctum has this massive coverage, and they kind of all overlap each other. So the whole globe is kind of protected from mystic threats. While the, you know, we get this line, while the Avengers protect the world from, you know, real world threats, that, you know, Strange and these folks now are protecting the world from mystic threats. So now we get a sense of Dormammu. He's our big boogeyman. We hear about the dark dimension, and we hear that Caecilius's pages are a link to Dormammu, to draw power directly from the dark dimension and bring it here. So, okay, kind of same idea, except instead of Mordo, it's Caecilius. So then the action starts. The London Sanctum door bursts open. So when they're standing in that library, there's three sets of doors, one to each sanctum. So the London Sanctum bursts open. The protector of the sanctum dies getting through the door, and we watch Caecilius destroy the London Sanctum completely. The magic blast throws Strange through the doors of the New York Sanctum, and he finds himself there. So he's back in New York. He walks around the sanctum, which is empty. He sees these three doorways, each to different parts of the world as well. So a little extra magic there. He walks past a museum case where there's a floating red cloak, which is something that we'll get to in a little bit. But downstairs, he witnesses Caecilius entering, and the Sanctum Master who is there confronts them. And there's a sword fight, which is not very well choreographed, with a lot of quick cuts, and the defender is killed. So then Strange, this brand new master, now fights these three bad guys. And, you know, he barely holds his own, which is correct, right? And runs in some ways. And in some of the fights, it's very Inception-like, where, you know, things are turning on their sides and they're using gravity and things are flipping up and around. And it's pretty cool, you know, at times. Strange winds up stranding one fighter in one of those doorways that we saw. So, you know, one person is out of the running. And ultimately, at this point, it's him versus Caecilius. And this red cloak comes smashing out of its case, protects him. The cloak kind of has a mind of its own, and gets him to throw this weird iron suit at Caecilius, which binds him up immobile. So basically, Strange has kind of won the day thanks to the help of this cloak. It's all very kind of Harry Potter-ish, frankly. But so to me, at that point, like, brand new Doctor Strange, the new guy, held off these three supreme baddies who are channeling Dormammu. I didn't understand, you know, the balance of power here. And in a superhero movie, it is very important, one way or another, that you understand the levels of power and who has it, who doesn't, and why someone wins and why someone doesn't win. And in this fight, I don't know why Strange wins. I don't understand why he was more powerful. It doesn't make any sense to me how he lost and how Caecilius lost. So who knows? But so now Caecilius is basically giving him the villain speech of, you should come over to our side. And, you know, the whole deal with Caecilius is that he wants to annihilate time. Time is the enemy. And in the dark dimension, there is no time. It's a timeless place, right? But we don't know why Caecilius wants to stop time. We don't hear, like, maybe in the past something terrible happened to his family or something, right? And there's something about the passage of time that's impacted him in a horrible way. There's no motivation for the villain. He's just a villain, and he's just given us the pat villain speech. It would have been interesting here if Caecilius actually held out something really, really attractive for Strange to want to come into the dark dimension, maybe saying, you know, they're showing you parlor tricks, but I can heal your hands for real without any BS. You know, something where there would be pause here, but none of it doesn't matter. Like, none of it really cares. And a lot of the close-ups with Caecilius just show us that bad eye makeup, which is like, you know, it's really bad. So then we get this bit of information that the Ancient One has used some of the dark dimension magic to allow her to live for so long, which, okay, you know, now we're complexifying things, which I don't think the film deserves or earns, but that's what it is. There's a moment when Caecilius realizes that Strange has lost his sling ring, so one of Caecilius' buddies gets up now and he wounds Strange. The cloak saves him, and he's able to get out of there and port himself to Christine's hospital. And now the film kind of swerves into half comedy adventure, which is just, you know, it's weird. So basically what's happening is he's on a table and he, you know, projects his astral self out of his body. So he's unconscious physically. His astral self then comes through to the real world and Christine sees him. And she, you know, she's astonished kind of to a degree, but recovers very quickly and starts taking direction from him. You know, hand me the scalpel or go do this thing. And now at this point, when I'm watching the film, I'm like, well, there's no rules here. Like, nothing matters. Like, it's everything's kind of willy-nilly. There's no big deal for her seeing him, which to me should be a huge big deal. One of Caecilius's bad guys then also astral projects out of his body. So there's this astral projection fight between the two of them, which is very hard to follow. And I don't really understand what's going on. They're just kind of fighting. I think someone said, hey, why don't their astral projection selves fight? It'll be cool. But the whole thing is played for farce. It's very lighthearted. He's joking with her like, I'll be back in a minute. Keep me alive, you know. And he beats the guy because she uses electricity on his body when she tries to jolt him back to life. And he uses that power to sort of take the bad guy down. And it's just, I'm left completely bewildered. Then he comes back to the Sanctum. Mordo is there. And the Ancient One, he gets promoted to Master of the New York Sanctum because he held off these guys. But he calls her out for drawing power from the Dark Dimension in front of Mordo. And Mordo's now very confused because, you know, Mordo's kind of like the rigid purist, right? And he's kind of freaked out by that this could happily happen. But she doesn't confirm or deny any of it, just kind of leaves. So then Caecilius returns for a second attack. I mean, we've just had a battle in the same location, and now we have a second battle. And it's like, okay. But Strange now brings them all into the mirror dimension, steals Caecilius' sling ring. It's him and Mordo who are running from Caecilius through the streets of New York in the mirror dimension. And there's just a lot of, you know, Inception level deformation, which is a lot of fun to watch. But at this point in the film, I'm kind of done. I mean, I'm really, really done. I feel completely untethered. I don't feel like there's anything here that really matters, that I've been brought here in any way that I would care. Brief Stan Lee cameo as he's reading, I think, Huxley's The Doors of Perception. I think it's Aldous Huxley's. And he's laughing at it or something or whatever. It's a very brief cameo. So finally, the Ancient One arrives, and now the battle is had, right? And she's challenging Caecilius and her crew. And Mordo does see that she does draw power from the Dark Dimension. The fight is over very quickly, but it's overcut and showy. It's not very engaging. But there's this moment where I think one character gets between the Ancient One and Caecilius, and the Ancient One is stabbed underneath the person's arm. Very Shakespeare, right? And she lands in a heap in real New York City. You know, then it just keeps going back at the hospital. The Ancient One's now back at the hospital, and, you know, they operate on the Ancient One, but he chases her astral form as she's taking off as her body's being operated on. Then we have this last moment of her and him, and she's like, you know who you are, Dr. Strange? Your whole problem is ego, and your problem is this, and you have to do that, and you have to do this, and these are all your flaws, and these are your good points. And it's the worst kind of writing because we haven't seen any of it and none of it really matters. We're just being told that. So, you know, the film hasn't really shown us that. The film has shown us that he's a jokey guy who he's great at everything he does. And now that the Ancient One's saying that he's this deeply flawed person and has to do X, Y, and Z. And it's BS, you know, it doesn't really matter. So she dies. Nobody cares because she wasn't really a character either. Then we have a final battle in Hong Kong, which is just, at this point, it's really, really, I'm kind of exhausted. And the gist of the battle is that, you know, Hong Kong Sanctum's already been destroyed. Strange uses his time loop to bring it back. Caecilius is able to stop it. And then there's this is the final battle between Dormammu and Strange in this film, is him using the time travel spell that he learned to get Dormammu caught in a loop. So Dormammu keeps killing him over and over and over again, but Strange keeps coming back and saying the same lines over and over. And basically, Strange wins by annoying Dormammu to death. Dormammu finally begs to be released from this conundrum as a deal. Dormammu will, you know, release his hold on Earth and will never come through again. So, I don't know. Dormammu looks really goofy. It's a really kind of strange, like, bright pastel CGI face. It doesn't look very scary at all. It looks kind of goofy and childlike. And it's clever. And they do at least, you know, try to connect what he's good at, that he is using this time shift spell that he discovered because he wanted to do stuff on his own, and he's using it to win at the end. Like, okay, I think at this point, it's not enough for me to really, I don't think it's clever writing. I'm not interested because so much other stuff has not happened in the film. Of course, you know, all the bad guys get sucked back into the dark dimension when it collapses and it's all over. And then we have this last scene between Mordo and Strange where Mordo's like, I've been betrayed, everything I've worked for and fought for is a lie, and I'm out. So he quits, and I'm sure set up to be the bad guy of the next film. And we stop. Back in Nepal at the headquarters, Wong tells Strange that the Eye of Agamotto is actually an Infinity Stone. So they're tying it into the larger Infinity War movies to come, and we're out. To compare these last two and have some final words to say, I feel like they wait so long in the animated film for Strange to come into his powers that when he finally does, it all makes sense and it's very satisfying. He's coming full circle now, using the power that he discovered in himself through all these trials and errors that he went through that we saw. And they, you know, the animators risked that Strange wasn't in a lot of the battles. Like, he wasn't in a lot of the fights. He was only in, like, you know, one with Mordo at the end and then with Dormammu. So really, he didn't kind of come in to the film as a potent protagonist until the very end of the movie. But it worked because it was a good story, and he wasn't ready before then. So there were three battles, you know, one in the very beginning, the Shadow Hounds, and then again, the other two big creatures that Strange wasn't involved in at all. And so they didn't jump this up. And by the time you get to the end of the film and he does have his fights, he wins them in really cool ways that are very satisfying and that make sense. In the live action film, it's just nothing is really clear about what his skill level is, what he's doing, how he's beating people. The fights between the different people that are happening are not really tied to any stakes. Like in the animated film, like he's going to lose all those children and Dormammu's going to really get pulled in. And there's something about that that works, whereas, you know, Caecilius and his anti-time thing, like, there's no real stakes in the live-action film. I don't really feel that it matters. I just feel like, oh, they got to stop the bad guy. And it's all very light. I mean, ultimately, to summarize the two films, I feel like the animated film, they made a real movie. Like, believe it or not, you know, animated or not, they wrote a real movie. And they had the character come forward when the character was ready to come forward. They made the spiritual journey really matter. It was a very serious film. There were some comedic moments. It kind of had like Nolan comedic moments, which are very kind of low-key, but there. Whereas the live-action one, they really wanted to make it a Marvel Cinematic Universe piece of entertainment. So it stayed light. And when you're doing a mystical spiritual journey movie that's supposed to be somewhat deep, you know, and you have a jokey character that doesn't really get hurt and doesn't really sacrifice and doesn't really sweat much during most of the film, it doesn't really matter. And the villain in this, like the Baron Mordo in the first one, man, you were a little afraid when him and Strange were going at it, you know. But Caecilius in these movies, it just doesn't gel. It doesn't knit together because I think either there were too many hands in the pot or they just didn't trust the story to play out as a story. It had to be this entertainment machine and had to have a certain amount of fight scenes and a certain amount of, you know, deformation sequences so they can, you know, wow us in the trailer. I think ultimately, to summarize, the live action film didn't want to be a movie. It wanted to be a piece of entertainment, whereas the animated film decided to be a movie. And it told a great story very simply and very well, and it really works. And the live-action film just is all over the place. And I really didn't enjoy it. I was really disappointed, and I really wanted to kind of show this by comparing and contrasting with the same bloody story done, you know, 7-8 years earlier that was done perfectly, that worked, and why they didn't use that as a template. And who knows? It's a billion, you know, multi-billion dollar entertainment conglomerate. They know way more than I do about pretty much everything. But so anyway, that's pretty much my comparison of the two. I've been keeping you here for like an over an hour and a half. So I'd like to wrap things up. Archive versions of Sci-Fi on Screen are available on my website for 99 cents a show. I've got about 80 plus shows and growing, and there'll always be a good selection of recent and other shows for free, obviously on my podcast feed. So just want to remind you guys of that, and I will see you next time.